This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair, OMFIF. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Amaya Scarity. And in today's podcast, I'll be continuing to drill down on macroprudential policy in the United States. Amaya is now a partner at QED, a venture capital firm in Alexandria, Virginia, focused on finding new investment opportunities on back office technologies and infrastructure companies. Before that, Amaya served for 8 years in the U.S. Treasury, and he did so with intelligence, distinction, and collegiality. Throughout, he was always trusted by Secretary Geithner, Secretary Liu, and all of the senior command of the Treasury. His last job at Treasury was as Acting Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions, a position in which he served as lead advisor to the Secretary on all policies affecting financial firms. And prior to that, Amaya served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC, an interagency group of financial regulators charged with monitoring and mitigating potential threats to financial stability. Amaya is one of America's foremost practitioners and experts on the FSOC, the key U.S. macroprudential body. Welcome, Amaya.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here and glad to join the conversation.
Great. So a few weeks ago, I had a podcast with Nellie Lang, a former colleague of yours. She headed up the Fed Financial Stability Division. And like you, she's a leading expert on macroprudential policy in general, as well as in the United States. Macroprudential policy was obviously something that wasn't talked about much before the financial crisis. Nellie has written a recent article examining macroprudential bodies that have been created across the world, and sometimes in central banks, sometimes in finance ministries. I wanted to drill down on the FSOC today and build on that podcast. First of all, since you were one of the FSOC's primary architects, you should probably be pleased that Nellie, a very keen analyst, has given the FSOC very high marks for its construct. And maybe that's a good place to begin. Can you give our listeners a brief thumbnail sketch of what the FSOC is?
Yeah, sure. I like to think of the FSOC as a Justice League of regulators. So what the FSOC did in the Dodd-Frank Act is it creates a framework where every one of the lead financial regulators have to come together to think about the system as a whole. And just like the Justice League, each of their powers is not enough to tackle financial stability, but together they should have the requisite authority to tackle the big challenges facing our financial system. Now, of course, the FSOC's powers themselves are actually pretty limited. So one of the really important things it has to do is it has to report every year to Congress annually on the risk. So this creates the accountability framework. It has the authority to name and shame its members or to name and shame regulators more generally. And that creates pressure for each of its members or the financial industry more generally to focus on specific practices that could be creating risk. So that's a really important mechanism for market discipline. And the most direct authority it has is the ability to bring large, complex financial firms under Federal Reserve supervision. So at its heart, these powers together are an attempt to shift the focus of our regulatory approach from one based on charter and business line to one based on risk in the system more generally. And I often think that the distinction between microprudential and macroprudential in this context is a little bit hard to decipher. Part of that is that we can use a simpler frame. And the FSOC is really tasked to thinking about the system, thinking about the risks that are underappreciated and underaddressed. So, for example, one of the things that the FSOC took on, which is not traditionally thought of as a macroprudential issue, was cybersecurity. So that doesn't flow naturally from a macroprudential framework, but it was a very large risk and it was underaddressed when we thought about the financial regulatory architecture. So that's an example of one of the areas that the FSOC used its overarching view to try and bring underaddressed issues to the fore.
Well, fantastic. That's a great background, tremendous introduction into the FSOC. You've just described what the FSOC designed to do. You also created a good bit of structure around this. You had meetings of principals and deputies and other groups. To give the listeners just a view on how comprehensive the bureaucracy, the institutions worked on the FSOC, could you just outline it briefly for us what the structure of the organization was?
Yeah, Mark, it's underappreciated how important process and structure can be to leading to good policy outcomes. And so one of the things that we were very focused on is creating an infrastructure that would really surface issues from staff all the way up to principals in a way that was open enough to be thinking about the future, to be looking at corners, but also structured enough so that the policy discussion would be relevant and actionable. So just to give you a brief sense, so principals of the FSOC, those are the statutory members, the chairs of all the regulatory agencies. Below that, we had the deputies committee, and the deputies committee were people like Nellie Lang, people like the chief of staff or someone like that at another agency. And the deputies committee actually met every 2 weeks. So it was quite a regular and quite an engaged body considering the seniority of the people who participated in the deputies. And then we had a series of committees that met more like once a month, but were structured to look at specific statutory authorities and specific issues. So there's a systemic risk committee, which was supposed to be open-ended and analytical. There's a non-bank designations committee, which was intended to just constantly review the landscape of non-bank financial companies and had the authority for guiding the actual analysis in the non-bank designations process. Similarly, there was a committee focused on financial market utilities, et cetera. So what we had is a series of staff committees, which were quite well constructed in terms of topics. Each of them waxed and waned in terms of activities, but our goal really was to create deep connectivity between different agencies and create a dialogue of sorts that wasn't always restricted to the most senior members of the regulatory community. Because I think even before the FSOC, there were other bodies that allowed very senior members to come together and talk about issues. But those dialogues were naturally more constrained because they weren't built off an infrastructure of deep engagement at the staff level. And what we really tried to create in the FSOC was an opportunity for that deep engagement at the staff level to then bubble up in a structured way, ultimately be influential from a policy perspective, and try to give principals the information and the options that they needed to make our financial system more secure.
Well, thank you for that. I think that the comprehensiveness of the dialogue among the regulatory agencies and the structure itself are underappreciated. You have just brought it to light. So to put it a bit more concretely, in your years at Treasury, what did the FSOC actually do? What were your proudest accomplishments? What created the greatest controversy?
I think there were some great accomplishments. There was certainly a lot of controversy. When we started, the FSOC was created by statute to have its members and nothing else. And so my first job really was to become the first staffer to the FSOC and ultimately to build a team of staff that could form a kind of secretariat, as many other macroprudential and policy bodies have in the financial regulatory system. So our first focus really was on building the systems and then trying to build a sustaining culture of collaboration on risk. And this is the place where Nellie and I spent so much time together and with other senior leaders across the regulatory system. So we wanted to create a culture where each regulatory body, not just at the principal level of discussion, but at the staff level, was really collaborating to say, what are you seeing? What are you worried about? And what could we do about it? Beyond that, we had specific mandates that were tied to addressing risks that were independent of specific statutory mandates of Dodd-Frank. So Dodd-Frank had a very significant program of reforms that each of the regulators were required to put in place. And on top of that, there was an overlay of the Financial Stability Oversight Council trying to look at risks that maybe hadn't been adequately addressed or that were emerging even in the post-crisis environment. So I think probably the thing that I'm most proud of in the FSOC was that culture of analysis and the culture of accountability. So the process of requiring each member, so the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the chair of the SEC, the chair of the CFTC, all to look at each other's pieces of the financial system and to report to Congress each year, these are the risks we think are most important, these are what we are worried about, and this is what we think should be done. That was a really important culture of accountability, and I think probably at some level the most important thing that wasn't in the statute that we tried to create within the FSOC. Of course, there are more tactical things, so we designated financial market utilities, these are central counterparties, market infrastructure, and thankfully that process was pretty uncontroversial, but it created an important opportunity for much stronger collaboration between the Fed, the SEC, and the CFTC. And then some of the other things that I'm proud of were much more controversial. So we designated four large, complex, and non-bank financial companies, each of whom have now been de-designated, and one of whom fought us and actually won in court saying that our process was not appropriate. And I think this is unfortunate because the conversation that we had, in particular around the large, complex financial companies that happen to have insurance as their primary business line, ended up getting inflected with debates in the U.S. about whether, quote-unquote, insurance was systemically important, and then about the right of states and about the authority of states to regulate insurance companies, instead of debate really about the complexity of those companies and the importance of oversight of the largest and most complex financial firms in the country and the world. I think our efforts on asset management were also hugely controversial, and for similar reasons. So, for example, the FSOC published a report recommending reforms to money market funds. And I think, as most listeners will remember, money market funds were a really key propagant for the crisis in the large complex financial firms to propagate out into more general money markets and from there into more general financing costs and freezes of financing in the broader economy. And the reform of money funds was a place where the SEC clearly had pre-existing and plenary statutory authority to pass the reforms. But for a variety of reasons, the commission was unwilling and unable to act. And actually, the acting chair at that time, Mary Shapiro, actually asked the FSOC to publish this report and make this recommendation. And here, too, the industry became very impassioned and put together an intense lobbying effort to argue that these money fund reforms should not be put forward. Ultimately, the FSOC did publish a report, and the SEC did pass these reforms, which are now put in place. We also took a look at asset management risk more generally, looking at hedge funds, looking at private funds, looking at modernization of the regime for reporting. And here, too, there was very intense lobbying by the asset management industry that really got focused on the question of whether asset managers should be designated, instead of being focused on the question of what is the appropriate reform and the appropriate risk that we should be thinking about when we think about the asset management industry. So my big takeaway is that risk-based regulation is really important, but also really difficult. And I think what we saw whenever we tried to do something that was complicated and difficult is that industry lobbying and other lobbying efforts would really get focused on keeping clarity and keeping the idea of, you know, you need narrow rules, you need to be able to predict what's going to happen. And the role of the FSOC really is to push back against that and to say, we need to follow risk where we see it as it develops in the financial system. And that's a, both a very difficult and very challenging analytical task, and ultimately it proved to be a very challenging political task.
Well, thank you. You reminded me in listening to your discussion that the four firms, I think it was MetLife, GE Capital, AIG, and Prudential, many of them substantially changed their business lines in response to the FSOC inquiries. And you also reminded me about how ferocious the asset management lobbying was. You didn't mention, if I may be provocative, the Volcker Rule. Do you have 30 seconds for us on the Volcker Rule?
Yeah, I think the Volcker Rule is something that I spent a lot of time on. And one of the things I'm most proud of in the Volcker Rule is that although the statutory framework actually could have enabled as many as four different Volcker Rules, we got the agencies to write a single one. The other thing that's interesting about the Volcker Rule, and maybe just to step back and explain what it is, the Volcker Rule states that take insured deposits cannot also do proprietary trading off their balance sheets. And the primary point of controversy around the Volcker Rule was this question of how you do distinguish the general risk-taking that happens in any market-making activity from true proprietary risk-taking, which was so prevalent off the balance sheets of large financial companies prior to the crisis. This is a really difficult challenge. And actually, Paul Volcker himself always said, you'll know it when you see it. You just need to write the rule and then give the supervisors latitude. Industry, and I think the legal framework that we operate under today, made that approach difficult to institute in practice. And so the complexity of the rule ended up being a real source of controversy, although I think the principle behind the rule is very strong and very powerfully supported. It's something that you can explain to people regularly. You can say, if a firm has insured deposit taking from the federal government, should they also be able to do risky speculative trading on their own account? And the answer that most people give when they're presented with this question is no, they should not. Now, bringing that into light and bringing that to life was really difficult. And I think one of the things that we're seeing in the rulemaking now is that the current regulators are trying to make it simpler, trying to make it less tight, but they're also struggling with the exact same problems. And so some comment letters that we've seen have actually had industry say, you know, you've just made it even more complicated in trying to deregulate on the Volcker Rule. We were happier with where it was before. So I take some pride in the fact that although we took a huge amount of criticism for the way we implemented that rule, the efforts to deregulate on that basis without changing the law are actually running into the same complexity and the same challenges that we worked so hard to work through and to make a rule that was both true to the intent of the statute and also operationally capable for the firms that were subject to it.
Well, thank you for that. So let's move on. I wanted to distinguish a bit between banks and non-banks. So Dodd-Frank mandated that any bank with more than $50 billion in assets would be under the consolidated supervision of the Fed. I think that was bumped up to $250 billion. I do think it's fair to say that the major U.S. banks are far better capitalized these days. They have more robust liquidity coverage. Leverage is down, certainly relative to the pre-crisis period. You know, there are debates now about whether some of the recent Fed easing of prudential regulations is warranted. That doesn't change, in my view, the basic judgment that the banks are much more solid now and don't appear to pose financial stability risk to the system. Now, let's underscore now, I assume you agree with that. But
yep.
Regulation and oversight of non-banks is less clear-cut. I think you were alluding to this already. There are all types of non-bank activities. You mentioned money market funds, hedge funds, finance companies, leasing. Their oversight isn't under the Fed per se. It's dispersed. Yet the non-banks can be huge. I think I read recently that one asset manager had total assets of around $6 trillion. And non-banks engage in activities, repo, for example, that can give rise to leverage, maturity, transformation, run risks. So as I understand it, the potential for systemic risks emanating from non-banks was a special focus of FSOC. So how did you approach this task? I understand that the regulators felt it was better to focus on non-bank activities rather than entities. Perhaps you could touch on this for us.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that the degree of diversity in our financial system globally is quite significant as a huge amount of complexity. I talked earlier in the Volcker Rule about the difficulty of writing a rule that handles the complexity of making these judgments. And I think a lot of times when we hear people complain about the complexity of rulemaking, they often are just reflecting the fact that the rules are trying to govern something that is inherently complex, and it's difficult to govern something complex without a complex rule, certainly in our legal architecture. I think one point that I'd like to make, Mark, is that Dodd-Frank is actually stronger on non-bank financial activities than I think many people realize. And one challenge in the public perception of the post-crisis regulatory regime is that there was no stated policy to address things like shadow banking. There's no section in Dodd-Frank that said, and here is where we address shadow banking. And yet, collectively, when you look at Dodd-Frank, the complete transformation of the regulatory regime around derivatives, the requirement for risk retention on securitization, the requirement for transparency at the asset level for securitizations, the attempt to increase transparency around credit rating agencies, the regulation of financial market utilities, all of these things together actually do a tremendous job of putting some guardrails around the pieces of the non-bank financial system that really were central to shadow banking and central to the path of the crisis. So I think that is where I'd like to start, is what did Dodd-Frank already do, putting margin, capital, risk retention inside of the core non-bank financial activities that really had to do with credit and leverage? But it also, as you mentioned, put the FSOC in a place where the FSOC was required to look out across this landscape and as it changed over time and try to identify activities. And certainly, for example, one area which you brought to light and I think is really critical and is a place where I think we started to do work but have not done enough is around looking at the repo markets. So repo markets were central to the crisis. Worries in the tri-party repo were significantly addressed by the Fed with support from FSOC. But bilateral repo markets continue to be really underregulated in the sense that they're only regulated by virtue of the people who participate in them largely being banks or other regulated entities. And there's no central way to look at bilateral repo markets, capture the data, and really understand the risks that are taking or set rules for those. And this is another area where around secured financing transactions, the FSB and others have made significant efforts without actually coming to a true policy position. So that's an example, and I think a lot of credit goes to the OFR for moving the ball forward on this, but it does demonstrate.
The Office of Financial Research,
also created by Dodd-Frank, also within Treasury, meant to support support the Financial Stability Oversight Council and had data gathering and analytic authority. And they took the mantle of trying to understand bilateral repo markets. They pushed that forward. It was a long, difficult process to try and start getting data gathered. Even within that, they never, I think, have gotten it to fully deployed their data gathering efforts. And I think so we do sit in a place where there are still gaps in our knowledge and gaps in our understanding of risk. I think the other thing that your question raises, Mark, is a distinction which the current members of FSOC have made between activities-based analysis and entities-based analysis. And in particular, in a recent attempt to make the FSOC designation authority much harder to use and I think much less likely to be used over time, they've created a framework where activities-based analysis and rules should always precede entities-based analysis and rules. And I think this is actually a pretty significant problem. And it tends to really overstate the extent to which activities and entities-based regulation fulfill the same goals. In my view, activities-based regulations are appropriate. In fact, we've already talked about a number of instances where the FSOC took a look at activities, whether it was money market funds, whether it was looking at the asset management industry, whether it was looking at repo, whereas entities really are structured to be collections of risk tied to specific funding and specific organizational choices. And because of that, they're not really subject to the same types of regulatory pressure or regulatory effectiveness that you could have in an activities-based approach. So to illustrate, we could take the example of Lehman Brothers pre-crisis, right? It's certainly true that Lehman Brothers engaged in a large number of risky activities. And in fact, many of those activities became regulated in the post-crisis environment. So if you wanted to attack the risk of Lehman Brothers from an activity-based perspective, you would have to say, well, we need to have new regulation of subprime mortgage-backed securities. Well, we actually did that post-crisis, but you'd also have to have had regulation of derivatives markets, and you also would have had to have regulation preventing the quote-unquote repo 105 activities where, because of a quirk in accounting rules, Lehman was able to hide its degree of leverage. All of those things would have needed to be regulated. You also would have needed to have activity-based regulation around money market fund concentration. And in fact, we worked on that with the SEC after the crisis. So when you think about an activities-based approach versus an entities-based approach, you find that even with that long list of activities-based regulation, you still would not have addressed the fact that Lehman Brothers was operating at tremendous leverage ratios and with very weak liquidity standards. And so even with a very long list of activities-based regulation, you still could have entered a situation where, because of Lehman's choices on capital and liquidity, they could have still failed and created tremendous problems for the financial system. So when I think about what the FSOC has done most recently, I worry, because I think they are putting us in a place where, by trading off activities versus entities, they're not recognizing just how important these two different tools are for different kinds of risks.
Well, that is very helpful. You've definitely anticipated my final question. I did want to ask you perhaps how you had seen the evolution of the FSOC over the last 2 years since you left the administration. And I had wanted to ask you precisely about this new FSOC proposed interpretive guidance on non-bank financial company determinations. I was struck in reviewing it by the heavy focus on activities-based approach. Certainly the international regulatory community have been gravitating in that direction during your tenure, but you make the point that you need activities and entities. And then the other things that struck me about it that perhaps you might offer a view on were the very heavy focus on cost benefit analysis and then the streamlining of the determination process, as well as the very heavy associated focus on mitigation in the proposed notice. I was wondering if you had any thoughts more specifically on that beyond what you've already outlined.
So let me talk first about the sort of the path of the FSOC over the last 2 years. And I would say that in general, I'm worried. The reason I'm worried is that the authorities of the FSOC really do depend on the regulatory principles themselves having a seriousness of purpose and a focus on potential downside risks. At its core, the FSOC is just a group of regulators meeting together and choosing to think about what are the issues in the financial system that they want to address and direct staff attention to and to collaborate on. And if they do not have a focus on potential downside risks, on potential risk to financial stability, the FSOC cannot work. It is not a self-actualizing policy framework. And I think what we see over the last couple of years gives us reason to worry that there is a lack of focus and a lack of attention. And I'll just give sort of two examples. So first, what we can see from the public statements of the FSOC is that there seems to be more public attention on trying to coordinate deregulatory activity than on thinking about potential emerging issues. And I think that's especially strange when experience and history would suggest that we're a lot closer to the end of a business cycle than the beginning. I'm not going to predict how long our current expansion is going to last, but I think we can guarantee ourselves that we're closer to the end than to the beginning. And so to be very focused on coordinating deregulatory activity rather than thinking about what are the issues that could precipitate a next crisis, what are the issues that could exacerbate a next economic downturn into financial impact, those are the things that I think the FSOC should be focused on, and I think what we see is that they're not. A second example, and this is kind of small, but I think it illustrates the issues I worry about. Even in the most recent FSOC annual report, which is supposed to be a report to Congress illustrating what is going on in the financial system, what are the key developments, and what are the emerging risks and what should be done about them, they actually changed less than I thought they would. So even in the FSOC annual report, they did not use the report to make an argument that deregulation would be good for financial stability. And in my mind, that's worrisome, not because they didn't agree. I think if they sincerely believed what is in that report, that would actually be good. It's more consistent with the view of the financial system that we had when we wrote the report before. But in my mind, it's worrisome because it suggests a corrosion of focus. It suggests that the report was put maybe a little bit on autopilot and remains a very high quality work of analysis by the staff across the regulatory agencies. But when it came to recommendations, so little had changed that I worried that it had been put on autopilot. And I would have almost appreciated the FSOC trying to make an affirmative argument for their deregulatory practices. Instead, they just left the report more or less similar to what it had been before, weakened at points here and there. But overall, not enough focus is suggested by the language that they used and the consistency. And that worries me a lot because the financial system is constantly changing. And so if they have a different policy view, I think they really have to use things like the FSOC annual report to explain how that different policy view connects to an emerging view of where the financial system is going. So that's my first thing, is I'm worried about lack of focus about the FSOC and lack of attention to the underlying mission. On the guidance for designations, this also, I think, is quite worrisome. The way I would describe what they have done is that they're dressing up a destruction of the authority in a blizzard of nominally plausible procedural additions. So practically, what they've done is they've said, we're going to look at activities before we look at entities. We're going to add a cost-benefit analysis. We're going to give a firm that is being considered for designation an opportunity to propose actions to take to lower their risk, and we will only designate if those actions are insufficient, et cetera, et cetera. And what you see collectively, and it's important to note, Mark, that when we designated firms under the Obama administration in the last iteration of the FSOC, it actually took 2 years. So it was a very thorough process. Hundreds of pages were written of analysis. Tens of thousands of pages of documentation were reviewed. There were dozens of meetings between the firms and between regulatory agencies. And so it was quite a thorough process, even before these added procedural hurdles were suggested by the current group. And I would say that by my calculations, this would mean that if the new guidance takes place, it would take 5 to 6 years of work just to designate a firm. And to illustrate how dangerous that is, just think about where the largest investment banks were in 2002. For example, Bear Stearns only had $40 billion in assets in 2002. That was one-tenth of where they were at the time of the crisis. So if you think about a process that needs to start 5 or 6 years before being able to be completed, the degree of foresight that you would need in order to designate a firm and to prevent the occurrence of these financial stability risks is too extreme, in my view, to be reasonably expected. And I think that's why I'm so worried by the procedural changes that they're making, is I think they will have this really drastic effect on the usability of this authority, in addition to the more general worry that I have that they're not materially focused on the question of emerging non-bank financial companies, because they're really more focused on trying to make this authority harder to use.
Well, thank you for that. I said I was going to ask a provocative question, and you certainly didn't shrink from the task. Maya Scarity, I wanted to thank you tremendously for helping us today in understanding the FSOC and better appreciating U.S. macroprudential policy, its strengths and its weaknesses.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate being able to do this.
It's been our pleasure to have you today. Thank you.